Coming up, it's Philosophy Talk.
Let's discuss television. We can all agree we're living in the golden age of it, but the reasons why are highly debatable.
How do today's best TV shows raise questions about gender, morality, identity, and the absurd?
Can TV really be a serious medium for exploring philosophical themes?
What have you been watching that makes you think?
If your gods are real, and if they're just, why is the world so full of injustice?
So you've decided to help me?
I don't know. There's a thousand questions. Is there a moral imperative to help you? Do I have a greater obligation to my community? Are you taking someone else's spot, someone who deserves to be here?
I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No, I am the one who knocks.
Join us for a deep dive into today's most philosophical television shows.
It's the new golden age of television.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
The following program is brought to you in living color on NBC.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW, San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ken teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're thinking about the new golden age of television.
We'll start by asking how binge-watching and on-demand viewing have changed the way we see the stories told on television and changed those stories themselves.
Then we'll dig deep into two of our current favorites, Game of Thrones and Westworld, which raise questions about identity, morality, and the absurd.
We'll also find out how one show upped its philosophical game by consulting with a real-life philosopher.
And we'll talk to you, our listeners, about your philosophical favorites.
But first, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Liza Veal, to explore the role of the writers in creating this new golden age. She files this report.
The trailer for HBO's new season of content, that means miniseries.
Right now is all that ever exists.
Comedy.
Put it down, girl.
Movies.
Berries. Good at killing people.
Documentary specials.
Imagine if we knew the truth.
May honestly make you wish for a sick day at home with your laptop.
Clearly at this point, TV has just eclipsed the narrative complexity of film.
That's Jonathan Nolan, co-creator of HBO's possibly too complex Westworld.
There's just no contest. When you get 10 hours to play with characters, you can go so much deeper.
Nolan says he used to hear from executives all the time that material was good, but too sophisticated for the audience.
And you kind of think, okay, with all due respect, what makes you think you're smarter than the audience?
But nowadays, with so many more platforms, not all shows have to have mass appeal. Executives have learned
the audience is incredibly smart. That's one of the sea changes. Just even imagine that conversation, given the quality and caliber of the shows that are being made these days. It's kind of hard to imagine that there was a moment like that.
Executives and producers are a lot better able to judge what their audience is like these days, thanks in part to social media. Ava DuVernay, who directed the movie Selma, among others, says the biggest gift when she came to television with her show Queen Sugar has been that audience back and forth.
Like, I can actually hear. They're telling me what they think, line by line, scene by scene, character by character. And so we brought some of that into the writer's room the second season. And, you know, I'm trying to kind of one-up the voice on social media. Like, I want to do the things that they're not thinking about.
These writers are constantly asked about their process, and it sounds like it's different for every show, and sometimes even every episode. Some rooms write almost the whole show collaboratively. Most divvy up episodes and only collaborate once they've got a draft from someone. Michael Patrick King, a writer behind Sex and the City and Will and Grace and a million others, most recently Two Broke Girls, spoke about this on a panel along with Mindy Kaling, who has her own show and previously wrote for The Office. This is his reenactment of trying to write something as a group, sitting around a table, staring at the same screen.
The idea of a blank page with TV monitors and 10 people around a room going in, on, in the, it's IE, IE, IE. I mean, to me, that is not writing as much as it is torture.
But those group-written episodes, I mean, isn't that the thing that always end up being sort of the best? Because you have all these weirdo little voices writing all these storylines. You put it together, and it's this very pleasing patchwork.
Yes, that's the reason you have our whole staff. Because everybody has superpowers, and it's thrilling.
Some of these writers' room dynamics are eternal. But right now, there's a real push to shift who's in the room. Audiences have shown an appetite for stories that aren't produced by all white male teens. Tanya Saracato with the Starz show Vita says for the first time, she doesn't feel like the cultural ambassador on a team.
My entire writer's room is Latinx. We have one cis male, too. And when they came, they all had been sort of the token in other rooms. So there was a lot of PTSD, and I'd be like, you're safe. You're safe now.
Rachel Bloom, a writer with Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, says breaking up those boys' clubs makes for more exciting television.
The culture of comedy writers' rooms in general are changing. So not only that women can finally express themselves, but men can also express themselves. And they can express vulnerability, and they can cry, and they can say, what you said hurt me right now. I think that's really important for the culture of comedy, and it makes us all better.
That is, if more enlightened comedy is what you're into. But if it's not, don't worry. It's not that television is moving in one direction. It's moving in every direction. There's just more of it. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Liza Veal.
Thanks for that great report, Liza. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ken Taylor, and we're thinking about the new golden age of television.
We're joined now by Alexander Nehemas. He's a professor of philosophy at Princeton University and author of many books and articles on art and culture, including Only a Promise of Happiness, The Place of Beauty in a World of Art. Alexander, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much. It's been a while, but I'm very happy to be talking to you again.
So, Alexander, you wrote a pair of brilliant, highly influential papers helping to establish TV as an art form. And you were talking about a phenomenon you called serious watching. But now we have binge watching, right? Now we have these different kinds of ways of experiencing television. So is it more serious, less serious? What's changed?
Well, actually not very much changed because seriousness is not a feature of the television. Seriousness is a feature of the audience. So you watch seriously. Whether it's a single episode or a series of binge episodes, you can look at them either seriously or not. And what I was arguing in that article was that television repays serious watching. Not all of it, by any means, but some of it.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And I wonder, the reason we thought we might focus on the phenomenon of binge watching as a mode of serious watching, perhaps we could put it that way, is that it does seem to me that it changes the relationship between the watched and the watcher. And for some, I think, interesting reasons, because I was a fan of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I didn't start out as a fan. I thought it was a joke, and a friend of mine said, oh, you got to watch Buffy. And then I loved even more the follow-up series, Angel. Now, here's one of the things that Joss Whedon used to complain about with Angel. The network would not let him tell a single story from beginning to end. They would let him have, for each season, a big bad, but each episode had to stand on its own. Watch episode X, you didn't have to have seen episode X minus one. They insisted that he make it in that format. But something's happened in television that has changed it completely. They get to tell these massive stories. How, as a creator, do you reconceive what you're doing when you know that people will watch it in series, but they will watch it at their own schedule? Some people may watch it only after its entire run is done, right? I mean, how does that change my attitude as a creator toward this thing?
Well, the first thing that you're able to do with that is to make your plots much, much more complicated than before, because the story continues. So if you watch two or three episodes or even more at a particular time, the history of the plot is going to be fresh in your mind. If you see the show once a week, you need to be reminded much more of what happened. And accordingly, the plot is not going to be ever quite as complicated, except for some transitional shows like Breaking Bad, which I think is precisely in between the weekly mode and the binge mode, if I can speak in those terms. So that's one thing. The plots are going to be much more complicated. The second thing is that the characters are going to be much more complicated. You don't have Dr. Welby being the same Dr. Welby at the first episode of the show and the same 8 years later or whenever it was that the show was finally ended. Here you have characters who not only develop in certain directions, but contain extremely complex and often contradictory features. I think one of the very interesting things in recent television is precisely the tendency to create flawed heroes. Nurse Jackie is a perfect example of that. Somebody whom you can see from many points of view and not be able to give an overall judgment about.
Okay, who in here is in so much pain they can't raise their arm? Okay, put them at the bottom of the list. The rest of you, we have about a 3-hour wait. Drug seekers, waste of time.
That's, I think, not only very important, it's actually very realistic.
I want to follow up on that because I think people were once trained to look for a rooting interest, right? The protagonist is just the protagonist and you have a rooting interest in the protagonist. And these days, I mean, I think it started kind of with Breaking Bad. Well, that was the extreme version. Maybe even Hill Street Blues had some of this. Like, what am I supposed to be rooting for here? And I think a lot of these creators say, well, you're not supposed to be rooting. You're supposed to be watching. You're supposed to be judging. You're supposed to be evaluating. But we so want to root for the protagonist unproblematically.
Well, yes, and that creates a very interesting situation. If you're rooting for a character whom, in some objective sense, you don't approve of, then you have to think about yourself.
Right.
Why do you approve of somebody that you really don't also approve of? And how does television manage to do that? And I think it does that much, much better than just about any other medium, frankly. Dexter, right?
Dexter.
Where you end up rooting for a serial murderer.
Yes.
I thought I could change what I am, keep my family safe. But it doesn't matter what I do. I'm what's wrong.
They stack the deck a bit because he only kills other serial murderers.
Right, right. But still.
but still, it's an incredible conceit when you think about it.
I totally agree with you, Alexander. We're in the golden age of morally complicated protagonists in television. So Nurse Jackie, Dexter, Dolores in Westworld, Tony Soprano, Walter White, Omar Little from The Wire.
Yeah.
This is part of the potential for serious watching of these shows that allows us to reflect on our own moral judgments. But one of the points you've made that I love about television is the idea that it's sort of the place par excellence to find depictions of friendship. That friendship's about routine actions and repetition. And we get to see, in a series, we get to see a pair of people week after week, episode after episode, doing, not exactly the same thing, but somewhat similar things. And that's something special that TV brings to the equation, at least TV of the serial kind.
Well, no, both episodic and serial TV, I think, have that because of the exposure to the people over time and to the routinization of the relationship. I think this is something that's very difficult to do in literature because what you have to do is to show boring interactions as boring interactions. That's why Flaubert's great novel, Bouvard and Pécuchet, is impossible to finish.
Okay, but I wanted to float a possible cost by you, which is, we don't necessarily really have that kind of date anymore. If we're watching things on our DVR, if we're watching things, on Netflix or something like that. Maybe it's a small cost, but isn't that a little bit of a cost to the friendship model?
You do lose that. But, as I wrote back then, when I wrote the thing about Plato and TV, every Thursday night you go from 9 to 11 watching the same shows, along with another 40 million people. And those shows depict routine. And your life becomes routinized because you're looking at those shows. So then you have to ask yourself, what am I doing here? Why am I watching this every Thursday? Why am I letting this commercial enterprise articulate my time?
So you gain freedom. Well, on that note, Alexander, this has been a fascinating conversation. I mean, truly fascinating.
Delighted to be part of the show.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about the new golden age of television.
Coming up, we'll dig into two of the most philosophically compelling shows on television, Game of Thrones and Westworld, both of which raise deep questions about freedom, mortality, and the human condition.
From sci-fi western to Westeros, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to the program. This is Philosophy Talk, and we're thinking about the new golden age of television. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Josh Landy. What TV shows are you watching that challenge your assumptions and make you think about things in new ways? Email us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature your suggestions on our blog.
We're joined now by Catherine Tolman. She's a professor of philosophy at Northern Arizona University and a contributor to Game of Thrones and Philosophy, Logic Cuts Deeper Than Swords. Katie, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Katie, I know you've been a fan, not just a fan of Game of Thrones, but you've published about Game of Thrones. So what is it about this show that lends it to philosophical analysis?
Well, I think that I'm particularly drawn to the different characters in Game of Thrones and how they represent different ethical issues or even different ethical principles. So in the publication that I had for Game of Thrones and Philosophy, I talked about Daenerys and her sort of encounters with the Dothraki and cultural relativism. I think in like more recent seasons, I'm interested in portrayals of gender and race and ability that various of the different characters represent. So like Tyrion and Cersei. So I think it's really just like the rich characters that like lend themselves really well to philosophical discussion.
Yeah, I mean, the issue of gender is fascinating because, you know, if you think about the way the show has evolved, it starts out with most of the female characters being presented as basically passive victims of their circumstances. And by now, we're living more or less in a gynocracy, right? You have all these powerful, not necessarily always morally pure, so think of Cersei, right? But you got Cersei Lannister, you got Daenerys Targaryen, you got Yara Greyjoy, Arya to some extent, right? Is that something that's been of interest to you, Katie, this sort of gradual evolution of the plot over the seasons that we've seen?
Yeah, I have to say that one of the things that drew me to Game of Thrones is the fact that there are like are so many rich female characters. Like I have, you know, grew up reading fantasy and watching fantasy movies where women are often lacking. And in Game of Thrones, you have so many interesting female characters. And that's not to say that like representations of gender are always like, I don't know, praiseworthy. But it's really interesting how like we can take Daenerys as the sort of classic example. She starts as this, like you said, passive character who's just sort of, you know, a victim of circumstances where all of these different men in her life, her brother, Khal Drogo, are just telling her what to do, essentially. And then we see her develop into an individual and the kind of moral decisions that she has to make later on and how she becomes a leader that people both love and respect without losing any kind of, I guess, like stereotypical femininity. So like Daenerys represents herself as a mother. She's the mother to everyone. So she's both like fully feminine and has some masculine qualities.
The world hadn't seen a dragon in centuries until my children were born. The Dothraki hadn't crossed the sea. Any sea. They did for me. I was born to rule the Seven Kingdoms. And I will.
Let me ask you a question about Daenerys.
Sure.
You mean, A, how many people has she burned with her dragons?
I don't know.
And B,
many.
By what right...
They had it coming, Ken.
By what right does she rule in Westeros? I mean, what's her right? And she comes with her dragons in force, and she kills many people with her army, right? So she does have a complicated arc, and sometimes her arc looks like the evolution from victim to kind of liberating hero, but then she makes all these mistakes. She makes all these terrible, terrible, deadly mistakes. And then, by what right does she claim any right to rule over the people of Westeros, to whom she basically says, submit or die? I don't know about that. I don't know that that's classic femininity. That's something else. That's the monster.
Well, I think that there are a lot of things you said there that are interesting. So I think one thing is like she always sees her people in terms of this sort of like mother-child relationship. You know, there's that scene which is highly problematic at the end of season 3 where everyone is calling her Maisha mother.
Misa. What does it mean?
She's old Kiskari Khaleesi. It means mother.
one of the great things about Game of Thrones is that you have a character like Daenerys, who on the one hand is like a super sympathetic character. We really want to like her in season one. And she has these dragons and this like mythical background, and it's really cool. On the other hand, like you mentioned, what right does she have to go and like conquer all these cities? This is something I talk about with my students when I'm teaching ethics. Like, is it okay in sort of white colonialist fashion to go and demolish these civilizations, even in the name of like anti-slavery?
But it does raise a question. I think it feels like a general question in the show, which is the question of legitimacy. How mm-hmm. does power, if at all, achieve legitimacy? Because you have all these different models
exactly.
of social organization. You've got a kind of loose affiliation in the Wildlings, all the way up to kind of a tyranny under Joffrey, and you even have tiny little bit of democracy at the Wall. Is there any positive model here?
The question of like legitimacy and ruling is really especially interesting with the Wildings. So it's the same thing with the Wildings, where it's like they kind of elect who is going to be the best ruler. That was Mance Rayder, but and then they, you know, refuse to be a part of like the Westeros Seven Kingdoms. And on the one hand, we think the Wildings are bad because they kill Starks and you know, Jon's against them or whatever. But then also with Jon's arc, we see, oh, these are actually like really interesting people, and maybe this is a better style of government than what we're seeing elsewhere. So I think Game of Thrones makes it kind of an open question about what sorts of encounters with otherness are things that we can accept and things that we can't. So like when we encounter other groups of people, maybe there are certain practices that we should just be like, okay, you know, maybe you eat, you know, horse hearts and that's part of your religion. Fine, that's cool. but if like rape and pillage is part of your cultural practice, maybe we should draw the line there. Yeah. And it's not entirely clear where that line is, and it seems like it bends throughout the show. But I think that's also true with life in general. So I don't think Game of Thrones is like giving us any answers, but it is raising these questions that are super interesting.
That leads me to a kind of consequentialist question. If the world is really messed up, is it bad to be good? Because, you know, Ned Stark is a good person in a terrible world. And you might think that if he'd compromised a little bit and just been a little bit corrupt the long run, things would have worked out better.
Yeah. Yeah, there's that scene where Renly Baratheon, you know, goes up to Ned and is like, hey, what we need to do, Robert is dead. We need to, you know, capture Cersei and take her children.
We must get Joffrey away from his mother and into our custody. Protector of the realm or no, he who holds the king holds the kingdom. Every moment you delay gives Cersei another moment to prepare. By the time Robert dies, it will be too late for the both of us.
And your mind's like, yes, Ned, take that deal. It's a good deal. But, you know, I don't know. I think that's challenging, because you might think like, okay, well, would that really work out? Is it okay for Ned to sort of stick with his values? I mean, obviously it's bad for him. He ends up like compromising a little bit because he lies in order to save his children. So maybe that's like some kind of middle ground. I don't know. I think that many of the Stark women represent a different kind of morality. So you have Catelyn, who seems, you know, she isn't this kind of consequentialist or deontological thinker. If we were to peg Catelyn in a sort of moral theory, she would be a care ethicist. What she really cares about are her family and what's close to her. I mean, maybe Arya is sort of similar in the sense that she's fighting for like her family. I don't know. Is revenge a part of care ethics? I don't know.
So what do you want to happen, Katie?
So starting in the beginning, I had this like beautiful story in my mind of like Daenerys becoming the rightful ruler with Tyrion by her side. I wasn't really into her getting married. I kind of liked the idea of her just being on her own. But I don't know. I think that she's going to like sacrifice herself. I think that'd be the best arc for her. And I think maybe most of the characters will. But I honestly have no idea anymore, and I just want to be surprised.
I want it to end like Hamlet, with carnage everywhere.
But even at the end of Hamlet, there's like a couple of people who are like, oh, you know, reflecting and being like, oh, we can learn from this.
Okay, Katie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thank you. That was fun.
Katie Tolman from Northern Arizona University, helping us think about philosophical themes in Game of Thrones. You're listening to Philosophy Talk, and we're thinking about the new golden age of television.
Another current show that's philosophically fascinating is Westworld.
I came back.
You know, if I could stay right here with you, I would.
Just sometimes I
feel like the world out there is calling me.
You're one of them, aren't you? You're not real.
Our Stanford colleague, Jorah Dannenberg, is a huge fan, and he joins us now. Jorah, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks, Ken. Great to be back here.
So, Jorah, we love Westworld, but what do you think makes it a philosophically interesting TV show?
Well, let me start by asking you a question about the show. Think about, within the world of the show, the Delos Corporation, who's invented this incredible technology that they can put to almost any use they would want to. They could make a race of slaves to do their bidding. They could make, you know, employees to replace all of the human beings. And instead, what do they decide to do with this unbelievable technology?
Build a theme park.
Not just any theme park.
And not just any theme park, but a theme park, the theme of which is a quintessentially cinematic genre from the history of American
they
film.
They could be solving world hunger. They could take over the universe.
They're capitalists, though.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm going to offer a partial answer to the question that I just raised by another observation about the Western as a genre. Westerns have this flexibility of allowing us to raise questions that are incredibly current and on our minds. The famous director Sam Peckinpah, when asked why he made a Western, which was really an allegory for the Vietnam War, said, well, the Western is a universal frame that you can use to bring up issues in a way that, for some reason, allows us to really grapple with them.
And yet somewhat targeted and delimited, right? Because they tend to bring up questions about justice versus revenge and sort of radical self-reliance versus community and different forms of community.
But notice how much more Westworld the show raises these distinctive modern questions that I think we are grappling with all the time about the role of privacy in our lives, the role of corporations trying to find out information about us, about escapism, about the fear that...
Yeah, the problematic that many of these robot things have, going back to Isimov and all this, is this. Well, you know, it would be really cool if we could make versions of ourselves that are very, very, very much like us, but they lack that total package of capacities that make us free, conscious, autonomy, so that they could be mere tools, but they would be really smart tools, they would be really human-like tools, and instead of having to enslave black people, we can enslave the robots, right? And we try to do that, but then it turns out we can't find the dividing line. When we get this bundle of capacities, we can't find the dividing line that says, okay, it's okay to enslave you, and we're going to be your masters, because whenever we do, it turns out that we built too much into the robots, right? And they start growing and rebelling and this, that, and the other thing. And you think, well, Westworld's another version of that story. And up to a point, it does seem like a version of that story. But then it says, we're taking you much deeper into the darkness than your typical AI robot android show.
The park is an experiment, a testing chamber. The guests are the variables. And the hosts are the controls.
Of course, we learn that, in fact, the designers, who are kind of, in a way, hijacking the Delos Corporation because they need funding, they all along have had something grander in view than just creating a race of slaves that we can exploit.
So Delos has something grander in view, right?
Right.
Because Delos has something about human beings in view.
And then I was going to add, and then second way in which, we're kind of going beyond this familiar trope of the genre, it turns out what they want to do with these robots is not just make them slaves, but use them as a kind of stepping stone to human immortality.
Right.
It was meant for the people who built this place. A tool to ensure their immortality. But I'm going to use it against them.
One of the things that's so great about the show is that it sort of simultaneously raises questions that feel very of the moment, like worries about privacy and big corporations collecting data on it, and these kinds of timeless things that we grapple with about the nature of freedom or the nature of mortality.
And the value of humanity, right? So humans have certain kinds of disadvantages vis-a-vis robots, like mortality.
Right.
Cruelty, conscience, right? Yeah. So there, it seems to raise powerfully that question of whether, in fact, we should want to be human beings, or whether it would be more desirable to port our consciousness, if that were possible.
If that were possible, yeah.
Into a certain kind of artificial life.
Right. It's the visitors that we're really studying, right? We're going to study every move they make. We're going to try and get the human program right down. We're going to put them to every possible situation and see how they react. We're going to figure out what the algorithm is. Turns out you can reduce it to 10,000 lines of code or something like that.
10,247, I believe, is the exact number, which is a lot of speculation about whether that figure is significant, I think, among the
And then you
fans
download
of the show.
That into an augmented body, and you've got an immortal person with all of his personality and all that sort of stuff, right? So
plus
it's about
you've got their data for marketing.
Right. Well, that's what I first thought. Oh, this is the greatest marketing tool ever invented. Right. But it's way more than a marketing
They're going to sell you something much more important than, you know, new soap or something.
Right.
They're going to sell you.
Right. There's this beautiful kind of crossing structure where these robots are becoming more and more human and wanting to become more and more human in most cases. And you got the humans wanting to become robots,
right?
And achieve immortality and try to have all the benefits without the downside.
Well, and there's one more way in which you might think the show goes beyond this familiar trope that Ken was just mentioning of, you know, the kind of the story of human beings trying to make an inferior race that they can treat as slaves. Of course, what we find out eventually is that the human beings are kind of the the simple ones, right? I mean, this point about the 10,247 lines of code turns out that human beings are much less sophisticated than they take themselves to be.
Correct.
And that maybe in order to really be free, you'd have to be able to rewrite your own code. And of course, we can't do that.
But they can. You know, maybe it's inevitable given my background. But I see this show as being, yes, absolutely, about human beings versus artificial forms of life and about free will versus determinism and about, you know, issues of identity and all kinds of things like that, but also about fiction, right? As you said, it's a theme park and it's alluding powerfully to Western. Every show has characters riffing on things like backstories and sometimes even criticize. Mm-hmm. That was a pretty pathetic backstory that you gave to that character. Oh, that's not very original. So this is, you know, this is TV in the golden age, in the Baroque age, a TV that's fully conscious of itself. Like, I want to run something by you. What if this is TV, you know, asking the question about the value of TV? This is fiction asking the question about the value of fiction. Now, the value of the theme park to the investors is cynical and grim, right? It's about harvesting data.
Right.
But the value of the theme park to the customers can actually, I mean, yes, of course, entertainment, but character after character talks about its value as a voyage of self-discovery. This is, of course, a big mistake that the man in black makes. He thinks that it's going to teach him an important lesson. He's going to find the meaning of the park and Ford, in a moment that I treasure, corrects him.
Is that why you came here, Robert? Talk me out of it.
On the contrary, far be it from me to get in the way of a voyage of self-discovery.
And I think that works at the level of the show too, right? So the customers going to the park within the show get to learn about themselves through the experience of that fiction. And we, the watchers of this show, the people who love Westworld and keep talking about it with our friends and going online and sharing theories, we get to learn about ourselves by grappling with these questions that they don't make easy. About what is moral and who we are and what are the limits of AI and are we free and all these great questions. What do you think about that,
Jeremy? I mean, I totally agree with you. The show is constantly reminding us in subtle and unsubtle ways about fictions of all different kinds. There's all of these allusions to Shakespeare, to the Bible, to Steinbeck, to Kurosawa, to Leone, to all of this stuff. It's also, I mean, it's in a way it connects to this thought before that the genre is especially useful for raising questions that are both very current and also in a way kind of perennial. So here's a current question. Increasingly, as the kinds of fictions that people find themselves drawn to become more and more immersive, should we be concerned by that or should we glory in it? Is it a good thing that we, I mean, so it raises these kinds of classical questions about escapism, but kind of taken to the nth degree because now you can escape into an entirely separate world. And of course, interestingly, different characters within the show have very different attitudes about this. Dolores, who's a product of this fictional world, keeps reminding us the only reality that matters is the reality out there outside of the fiction.
Right.
Whereas other characters want to stay within the fiction, which of course to Dolores is just, as she says at one point, another gilded cage. When are you going to realize?
That which is real is irreplaceable.
Is irreplaceable, right? And so there's some
existential weight.
And so I think all of these things are great ways to have an experience through which we learn things ourselves. And in a way, it gets back to your point about the mistake within the show that The Man in Black makes. The show is not going to teach us some lesson. It's going to allow us to discover things about ourselves, learn things, grow maybe in the way that other people in the show understand fiction within the show.
So, Jorah, wow, thanks so much for helping us think through Westworld together today. It's been fantastic having you back on the show.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you, Ken. This was great.
Stanford philosopher Jorah Dannenberg helping us think deeply about the hit TV show Westworld. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's the new golden age of television.
In our next segment, we'll talk to listeners about some of their favorite programs. We'll also talk to someone who has been, of all things, a philosophical consultant on a major TV show.
Philosophers on the set and in our audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're thinking about some of the most philosophically compelling programs in the new golden age of television.
We're joined now by Pamela Hieronymi. She's a professor of philosophy at UCLA, and get this, she has worked as philosophical consultant for the hit NBC show The Good Place. Pamela, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you so much.
So, Pamela, maybe it's because I don't live in L.A. and Hollywood, but, you know, I don't know too many philosophers who have been, like, had a hand in making TV or movies or anything like that. So how did that happen? Is that just something you L.A. philosophers do?
Not at this level. So it is the case that I often, once or twice a year, get a email from somebody who's interested in an idea that they have for a TV show or a movie. And if I have time, I usually like to talk to them because it's fun and interesting. So I got an email like this about what turned out from Mike Schur, who I didn't know who he was, but I said, sure, I would be happy to. And then as I was preparing for the meeting, I looked him up and I thought, wow, this is the person from Parks and Recreation.
Right.
This person
yeah.
is kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
So we met at a local coffee shop and just talked about his idea for maybe 3 hours, which was extremely fun.
Fantastic.
And then when the show came up for the second season, they invited me back. They actually invited me to the studio, to the writer's room. And I got to speak with the entire room full of writers, which was also extremely fun.
So tell us about the premise of the show and tell us a little bit more about how you helped them shape the show.
So the premise, the show opens with Eleanor, who arrives at, quote, the good place. So she's died and she's met by Michael, who is the architect of the good place. And Michael explains to her that she's arrived at the good place and starts to show her around. But Eleanor knows that there's been a mistake because Eleanor knows that she was not a good person and so really shouldn't be in the good place.
I honestly think I was just put here by mistake because Michael called me Eleanor Shellstrop. So he knows I'm me. He's just wrong about my overall quality level.
She's hooked up, as everybody is, with her supposed soulmate, who is Chidi. Chidi is a professor of ethics and moral philosophy. When Chidi introduced himself in that way on the show, when I watched it, I cracked up.
Yeah.
So Chidi is her soulmate, and Eleanor convinces Chidi to promise her that he won't turn her in or reveal her secret, but that he will help her to become a better person so that she might stay in the good place.
So wait a minute. Chidi, he's a moral philosopher, and
yes.
he engages with this not good person to yes. hide her not goodness?
To help her, yeah. So then things start going terribly wrong in the good place, and Eleanor has the suspicion that it's because of her presence, and the show takes off from that. But what Mike Schur was interested in when he was conceiving of the show, and I think the reason he reached out to me, was the puzzles and difficulties about how to become a better person when you don't start with the motivations to be a good person. And so I had a draft about that puzzle on my website, and I believe he just came across that and then wanted to talk to me about it.
That's great. That's a lovely question, right? So it's not just a question about what the right moral principles are. It's a question of how you sort of bootstrap yourself into any kind of moral sentiment.
That's a real question. And Eleanor has led a very problematic life, and then none of them are good people. They're all problematic people. Here's my question, though. Why the afterlife? Why not tell a story about people struggling to become good through their lives? I mean, what was the point of setting this in this problematic afterlife?
It's a great question. My guess, I did not speak with Mike about that question, but my guess is that he was very interested in having this points system and thinking about how much good a person had done in the course of their lives and comparing people.
When your time on Earth has ended, we calculate the total value of your life using our perfectly accurate measuring system. Only the people with the very highest scores, the true cream of the crop, get to come here, to the good place. What happens to everyone else, you ask? Don't worry about it.
Later in the show, some contractualist philosophers show up, and I like to think that was some bit of my influence to get them thinking, you know, not just about producing good, doing good things or producing good outcomes, but also, you know, several of Eleanor's first flashbacks are ways in which she's what gets called a free rider, where she's trying to never have to be the designated driver or what have you. And
right.
Especially now towards the end of season two, the importance of the quality of their relationships with one another and the importance of that to the original question of how it is that we become better people is really starting to come together. So yeah. I was very pleased to see that.
I thought you might say, because it doesn't play so much, a little bit, with the nature of divinity and all that, right? I mean,
no, right.
Because, you know, she even gets in there by mistake and says, what kind of divinity is that? But it doesn't
right.
play with that very much. But another thought.
But she's not really, she's in the bad place by design, not the good place by mistake.
I know, but we don't know that until the end. That was a spoiler. We
right.
don't know that until the end. But here's the thought that maybe, I think Aristotle says somewhere you can't judge a life until you have the whole life before you. And
oh,
so
right.
judging the goodness of a life is only after it's done. Maybe that's part of the thought.
It could be. It could be. I think the idea was just that we're used to thinking about judging a person's moral goodness from the standpoint of the eternal judge or from God or from religion. And so that just gave a real focus probably to the question he wanted to consider.
That makes sense.
Plus it lets him have flying shrimp and, you know, crazy things.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you another question that's going to depend on a spoiler. So again, you know, listeners, close your ears for a second if you haven't caught all the way up. But I love the way in which Chidi starts out the show as a kind of authority on moral behavior. But little by little, you start to realize that, in fact, all of his moral knowledge hasn't helped him to be a morally good person. And in fact, it seems as though at certain points it's actually been in the way because he thinks too much, he overanalyzes, he has experiences moral dumbfounding. And so in fact, all of this moral philosophy isn't any good for us morally. So I was really curious whether any of that, you know, is part of your thinking or maybe part of your experience around moral philosophers. I don't know. Was that something that you talked about with Mike or did he just pick it up by himself?
It's hard for me to remember all that we talked about in that first meeting, but I'm imagine that I did complain about how difficult philosophers in general, not just ethical philosophers, find decision making.
Right.
And so that definitely is a theme and definitely is a correct theme. And I'm sure that I would have expressed some doubt and maybe even amusement at the thought that you were going to have the moral philosopher be the person to make somebody a better person.
Right, exactly. When the show starts, it seems so rational, so sensible, so reasonable. Of course, it's the moral philosophy. He'll teach her what the right thing is, but in fact.
So, you know, this is cool. I'm glad you got to do this. It's good for the world. I'll ask you one last question. Are you happy with what they've done with your advice?
Yeah, I love it. Okay. I love it. Okay. I think it's fantastic.
Well, on that note, thank you so much for joining us, Pamela.
Okay, thank you.
Pamela Hieronymi from UCLA, talking about her work as a philosophical consultant on NBC's The Good Place.
And we've got a caller on the line. Mark in Morgan Hill, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Mark, what show from this new golden age of TV did you want to talk to us about?
So today I wanted to talk about one of my favorite shows, Breaking Bad, mostly. Mm. I also wanted to touch on the spinoff that's currently on air, Better Call Saul.
What piques your philosophical fancy about this pair of shows? I guess Breaking Bad is the main one that you want to talk about. What piques your fancy?
It was one of the most well-put-together shows I'd ever seen, and in the first few episodes, you know, you already have thought experiments being played out. You see the main characters well-developed, and mostly what I noticed was Walt is displays a lot of existentialist and utilitarian principles regarding his character and how he acts, and in those first few episodes, you even see him make sort of a utilitarian calculus to decide whether he's going to commit that first murder of his on Crazy Eight.
I mean, the thing that strikes me about Breaking Bad, I wonder if you think about this, is that you start out really cheering for Walt.
Right.
Right? You start out having a rooting interest. He seems this really put-upon guy and struggling to find a way to survive this deep kind of crisis that he's having in his family, and you're, like, pulling for him. And even when he starts making his turn to crime, you're pulling for him, but it gets darker
right.
and darker and darker.
If you don't know who I am, then maybe your best course would be to tread lightly.
And it's like the filmmaker did this on purpose, putting more and more distance between you and him, and then making yourself ask,
"Yes,
why am I rooting for this guy?"
Exactly. I think of this. I think of these shows as boiled frog shows.
Frogs.
Right? Where the viewers are like the slowly boiled frogs. And eventually we realize, wait, I'm cooked, right? I don't admire this guy morally. And what on earth was I doing? And we have to kind of retrace our steps to figure out what was the exact moment at which we should have gotten off the train. It's almost like a reductio ad absurdum in philosophy.
But you never really do get off the train. At least I found myself never. I mean, thinking I should get off the train, right? But I never could quite get off the train.
Yeah.
What do you think about that, Mark?
I think that was the point of the show as well. And it's true. Until about maybe season two, season three, Walt is more or less sympathetic. And you even feel yourself justifying his actions along with him sometimes, I feel. Because, you know, in many instances, it's the better of two evils is his decisions. But you really see that turn, and then his moral compass is truly gone. And you see his whole personality, his whole demeanor change along with it.
But that's something I think is a real feature of this golden age of television, that you have these morally complicated characters. I mean, think of Omar Little in The Wire, right? And these are shows that resist simple messages and easy empathetic commitments. And they're putting a lot of work on us to figure things out. Where exactly do we stand on all these things?
So let me ask you a question, Mark. Okay, given what Josh said, why did you keep watching this show? What were you getting out of this show? And then Better Call Saul. I mean, Saul. Oh, my God. Saul in Breaking Bad. I still remember this line from Breaking Bad from Saul. He said,
seriously, when the going gets tough, you don't want a criminal lawyer, right? You want a criminal lawyer. Know what I'm saying?
And then in Better Call Saul, I guess we see the evolution of this. But it's kind of complicated because he doesn't start out as the Saul that we knew and loved. He doesn't even start out as Saul.
Well, he's Slippin' Jimmy. He starts out as
Jimmy McGill.
Jimmy McGill is a little bit morally complicated.
So do you think that the moral universe of Better Call Saul, how does the moral universe of Better Call Saul compare to the moral universe of Breaking Bad? In Breaking Bad, we get this descent into darkness that we're carried along with. Well, how would you compare Better Call Saul with that?
So you definitely see the similarities. The structure of the show is the same. The character, you're seeing him, Saul, the main character, or Jimmy McGill, slowly become exactly who he was in Breaking Bad, which is obviously his moral compass is a lot duller, I would say.
Yeah.
But the moral universe, I mean, it's very realistic, though, I think. Especially Better Call Saul, I think the relationship between the two brothers of Jimmy and his brother, I think the stakes aren't as high. It's not life and death. It's not cooking illegal drugs.
Yeah.
Like in Breaking Bad, but it's the same sort of, you know, you see him breaking the rules, you know, regarding the law. You see him cheating, taking the easy way to get quick fixes for things or quick gains.
But I have a question for you, Mark. I'm wondering whether shows like this might not be an endangered species, you know, because we're increasingly seeing people calling for heroes of TV shows and movies to have, you know, total moral purity and for the villains to get served poetic justice, and anything short of that is thought of as something dangerous. Do you think that these difficult, morally complicated shows where there aren't clear heroes or villains are potentially an endangered species?
Endangered species. I mean, this was still fairly recent. I think of Breaking Bad as being, you know, one of the catalysts and sort of showing that extreme moral complication. In Breaking Bad especially, I see like each character's morality more or less as a character in itself. You really see the consequences of that morality play out, even though the choices were difficult and, you know, the morality wasn't so black and white to begin with, but there are always those consequences, so... I think that's fascinating, too.
Mark, you gave us a fantastic show to think about and lots of really great ideas to help us think about it with. So thanks so much for calling in today.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much.
You can find a list of all of the programs we've discussed on today's show at our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you've got suggestions of your own from the new golden age of television, send them to us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2018.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.